Good evening and welcome to VPR Debate for Lieutenant Governor. I'm Bob Kinzel with Jane Lindholm.
We've invited three candidates to tonight's debate: incumbent Republican Phil Scott, Dean Corin, the candidate of the Progressive and Democratic parties, and Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown.
Now, the candidates have agreed to our format, which includes time guidelines. They'll wrap up their statements when they see their time is running out. And if they don't, we'll gently remind them.
Tonight's debate includes rounds of questions that the candidates will ask each other and questions submitted by the members of the public. In this first round of the debate, though, Bob and I will pose questions to the candidates.
So let's begin with some questions about health care, a subject on a lot of people's minds. Phil Scott, you've been very disappointed by Vermont Health Connect, the state's health care exchange. $80 million has been spent on the exchange, and right now it's closed down because of security concerns. And you've suggested that Vermont drop its exchange and sign up for the federal plan. The cost of that would be roughly $8 million. But if that happens, Vermont won't be able to offer state subsidies to low and middle income people. So are you really prepared to increase health care costs on this group of people by going to the federal exchange?
Well, again, I don't think that's been determined. The last time I heard the governor respond to that question, he said, "It is my understanding that we would not be able to receive those subsidies." And so I think there's many ways to do something different. 27 other states have actually gone with the federal exchange. And they are working. I think Optum has been working with some of those states that have actually changed midstream and gone to the federal exchange in utilizing some of the subsidies. So I'm not sure that that's the case. The federal government doesn't want us to fail. They want the exchanges to work. So they're doing everything they can to help us through that.
There's been at least one court decision that has said states that have the federal model cannot have state subsidies.
And again, I don't think that's been determined throughout the extent of all of the exchanges. I realize that that one court has ruled on that, but I don't think that it's a mandate, and I don't think that that necessarily means that the federal exchange can't be construed in such a way to utilize those subsidies.
You've said that you're skeptical about single payer, but you want to have an open mind about it. So, what specifically has to happen to move you from being skeptical to supportive of this approach? What do you need to see?
Well, I've been saying the same thing for 3 or 4 years now. I remember when I was first put on the governor's cabinet, and that was asked to me, what is it going to take to get you to come on board? And I said, well, you're going to have to prove to me some things, basic things. Show me what the plan is going to cover. Give us that basic information, then determine how much that's going to cost, who's going to pay for it, and how do we do it? How do we implement that? So to date, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen no data, no details, nothing at all in terms of any of those questions. So I remain skeptical, and in fact, I'm concerned about where this puts us and the uncertainty that it places on Vermonters and Vermont businesses.
Dean Corin, I think there are a number of people who are interested in knowing how a single-payer healthcare system is going to be paid for, but the governor has put off this decision for 2 years because he says it's a very complicated subject. But last Friday, when you were on Vermont Edition, you said, hey, there's no mystery here. If you want to raise money based on a person's ability to pay, you've only got a couple of choices. You said you've got the income tax, the payroll tax, and perhaps a tax on unearned income. So share with our listeners now how you think you could raise $2 billion without hurting the state economy.
Well, first of all, it's important to appreciate, Bob, and good evening, that we're paying for it now. We're paying for every penny of it now. Our businesses that are providing health care coverage are paying an average of 15% of their payroll in health care costs. And so we're paying $5 billion a year now. Back when I was in the legislature in the 90s, we were paying $1.5 billion a year, and we were looking at reform because we knew we couldn't stay on that escalation path, and it would bankrupt the state ultimately, in addition to many families in Vermont that could not handle health care costs. Also, we see more and more businesses falling off of providing any kind of assistance for health care because they can't afford it either. Not just the cost, but also the overhead associated with that. What I said about the mystery, that not being a lot of mystery, is that in the first instance with tax policy, what you need to do, in this case, you have a $2 billion portion that's out of pocket that businesses pay and that individuals pay. And you need to match those flows. That's the payroll tax and the income tax. And we know what those numbers are, and we can start at that point and then move later on over a period of time to a more sensible system.
So as you mentioned, the average business that offers health insurance coverage pays roughly 15% of their payroll to provide these benefits.
Right.
And I think last week you suggested that perhaps a 7 or 8% payroll tax might be appropriate going forward. But if you phase in this tax for companies that currently don't offer these benefits, as you said you wanted to do, you're going to have a budget hole right at the start of several hundred million dollars. So where's that money going to come from?
No, you actually raise the same money we're spending now, but you raise it through these taxes. And the businesses that were providing good coverage before may get a cut. And the businesses that weren't providing any coverage before may have an increase because they weren't participating before. And so that's how you spread out the burden. Also, you put a mechanism in the payroll tax to have no tax on the first X number of dollars of payroll or a very low rate so that you don't put small businesses out of business.
Marina Brown, some people think that individuals have a right to affordable and accessible health care. Others disagree and believe that people have a responsibility to keep themselves healthy, and they believe that a free market approach to health care will ensure a fair amount of competition that will help keep rates lower. So what do you say? Is health care a right, and what kind of system would you want to put into place?
Health care is a right. I believe in paying for health care through a steep progressive income tax. I do not believe that the market distributes health care well, because if you get sick, you can't pay. So it's not a efficient or ethical way of distributing health care. There's people who are poor who cannot afford medical care. That's not ethical, and it's not the way we should be running a society. The free market, maybe it would work for music, but it does not work for health care, housing, any number of very necessary services.
So basically, are you supporting a single-payer approach with a very steep income tax?
I am, and with some payroll tax, but healthcare should not be tied to employment. If you're not employed, you should have healthcare. It shouldn't be a problem for small businesses because it should be decoupled entirely from employment.
This is the Lieutenant Governor's Debate on VPR. Let's turn now to property taxes and education. Dean Corin, you have said that you think we should lift the cap on income sensitivity so that all property owners pay a rate that's influenced by their income, all property owners. You'd shift some of the burden onto business and onto non-residential taxpayers. That doesn't address our school funding issue and spending. Do you have a plan for how you'd like to see the legislature address school spending and how much we spend?
Well, first of all, that is slightly different than what I actually described, but reasonably close. And I have focused on the fact that it's the property tax structure that's really burdening middle-income families. And it's not a matter of shifting more onto businesses. It's a matter of stopping shifting more onto middle-income families. So the structure of the property tax is by far the biggest problem. A secondary problem is how much we're spending on schools. And we've made a decision many decades ago that we're going to have top-quality schools in Vermont, and that's very expensive. And since that time, there have been additional mandates, both from the federal level and from the state level, having to do with quality and having to do with mainstreaming and assistance. And we are committed to keeping those things going. Could there be some efficiencies, improvements? Absolutely, without a doubt. There always are in every large system. But the recent proposals to do forced consolidation has never been shown to have any savings associated with it.
Are you talking about school board consolidation has never been shown to have any savings, or school consolidation?
School district consolidation forced by the state. Now, where you have a situation where you have schools that realize that they're too small to actually offer a quality educational experience that's broad enough to their kids, they can do that voluntarily and have done throughout the state. And the state can provide assistance, both technical and financial, in order to carry that out. But there's no indication that a forced program of the state to do that, and that's why it failed in the legislature last year. There's no indication that that would be helpful in and of itself.
So you don't believe that we fundamentally have a spending problem or a per pupil spending problem in this state? You believe that the main issue, the burden on taxpayers, comes from the structure of how we're paying for education, not the cost of it.
Right. That's simply a fact that that's the main problem. However, there's always a problem with spending money, and it's not the per pupil so much. It's our population, our student population has gone down. It will go back up again over time, but we can't, you know, create a structure that's not flexible to deal with that. The speaker has put together in the House, the speaker has put together a committee to come out with its own proposals, very independent, that will be helpful because they will put some proposals on the table. In addition to meeting the principles that we believe in terms of quality education, I'll be very, very eager to review those.
Marina Brown, the Liberty Union ticket supports cradle-to-grave education paid for by a steep progressive income tax. You've said that education is fundamental, but the issue isn't really whether or not it should be paid for, but whether or not the cost is commensurate with the quality, and if there's a way to cut down on the cost so that taxpayers don't feel like it's an insurmountable burden. So do you think the current cost of education is appropriate in this state?
I do. Things could be managed a little better. I believe that schools, colleges should be run by their staff, and a college should be run by their staff, the professors, and the students. And that cuts out a lot of highly paid administrators. Local schools should be run by the teachers, the staff, and with some input from the parents. I don't know the exact formula for that, but that I believe that would cut out a lot of these overly paid administrators.
So do you believe that it's the cost of administration and overly paid administrators who are creating the biggest pressure on the system right now? You said that you think there are efficiencies that could be found.
I don't know if it's administrators, but it is something I see a lot. My family's been in education for years, and it used to be my mother taught at a college that was run by the faculty, and the president of the college was a professor who taught, and he wasn't paid much more than the other professors. Now you see college professors, you see coaches getting paid more than administrators. That's not about education. That's extraneous to what education is.
Do you believe that we should adjust the mechanism for school spending, the current method through which it's paid, and the property tax burden on Vermonters?
Well, I believe education should be primarily paid for by a steep income tax. It should be also paid for by high-end housing, not low-end people who call themselves middle class, who are really just working people.
So you'd take it out of the property tax altogether for the main bulk of Vermont property owners?
Yes, I would.
Phil Scott, one of the major burdens on Vermonters right now is property taxes. And a main driver of the property tax rate is, of course, education funding. You've proposed the creation of an education care board that functions in a similar way to how the Green Mountain Care Board authorizes hospital budgets and works on health care costs. But Vermonters have long been opposed to top-down control of their schools. Wouldn't this be the state determining the budgets for local communities if it acts the same way the health care board does?
Well, again, let me reiterate what I said before. I think this is an idea. It's outside the box, something that we should probably consider because we have to come up with different approaches. We've been hearing from Vermonters for a long time, years, about the burden and the struggles they're facing in terms of property taxes. And they've wanted relief, and we've simply ignored them. The legislature has ignored them. Every election cycle, everyone says they're going to do something, and then we do nothing. And so I think it's coming to a head at this point. I believe that at this point in time, Vermonters are screaming for relief. So I've said for quite some time as well that rather than focus on a different formula, that we should be looking at the spending side. And if we change the formula, that's fine. But until we address the spending, what are we really gaining?
I know that you've said that this is just an idea still, but it's an idea that you've been talking about and that you're putting out there as one possible way to look at this. So could you go into a little bit more detail about how you think a board like this would be able to operate and what it might be authorized to do? For example, would the board be able to curtail spending to set the budgets of schools and school systems to such a degree that it would effectively force schools to close or to consider consolidation because they can't cut the budget to the degree that the board might tell them to?
Well, I think you might want to look at it a different way. And again, these are details that I haven't worked out. It's just the concept. But maybe when there's a high level of increase in budgets in a particular school or district, that they might have to come before the board to explain themselves. And I know the school boards are in that position now, but they are sometimes powerless in terms of the overall costs and the overhead and so forth. I've been in business for 30 years, and when we have a revenue issue, we have to look at our overhead, and you have to look at operating costs. And sometimes it's labor, sometimes it's becoming more efficient. And when we work together, and I've seen the way the Green Mountain Care Board has operated with some of the healthcare providers and hospitals and so forth, and they've done a great job in partnering with them, not mandating, not being a heavy hand, but actually working with them to try and create a better product at a more affordable price.
You're listening to VPR's Lieutenant Governor's Debate. I'm Bob Kinzel with Jane Lindholm. We have the three major party candidates here tonight: Progressive Democrat Dean Corin, Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown, and Republican Phil Scott. So let's go to another round of questions and look at the role of government in our lives. And let's look at gambling, Dean Corin. Right now, the Vermont Lottery raises about $20 million for the state's education fund. Some lawmakers would like to expand the operations of the lottery to raise more money to help reduce property taxes. What do you say about the Vermont Lottery? Is it a good way to raise money?
Bob, I think it's a terrible way to raise money, and I think there's nothing wrong or immoral about gambling. However, I think there is something wrong and immoral about the state tricking people into losing their money. And that's what the lottery is, and that's what gambling is. When I first ran for the State House in 1990, I was very eager to get in there and work alongside Governor Snelling. People don't know that about me, but I actually am a Governor Snelling fan. And one of the reasons for that was that we shared a common disdain for ever-increasing reliance on the lottery, which basically requires the state lying to people. A private company could not legally put out the ads that Vermont does, telling people that they will probably win when they will almost certainly lose.
So if it's up to you, would you get rid of the lottery altogether? And if the answer is yes, how do you make up that $20 million?
I don't think I would get rid of it, but I certainly would phase out advertising, which I think is deceptive. And I think that Vermonters should decide on, I think we have many other ways that we can tax things that are unfortunate so that we can help support things that are fortunate, that help work on building our economy and not getting us addicted to things like gambling.
I should have said at the beginning of this round, we're going to try to keep our answers a little bit shorter to get some more questions in. Marina Brown, what about the Vermont Lottery?
I don't think I can add anything to what Dean said. The lottery is just a tax for people who are not good with mathematics.
Would you get rid of it?
No, I don't believe it's immoral to have gambling, but I would not use it as a major source of income, and I would not advertise it. As I said, I can't add to what Dean said.
Phil Scott, what do you think about the lottery?
Well, I don't think you're going to find a lot of disagreement on this issue. I'm not a big fan. I would not get rid of it at this point, but I wouldn't expand it either.
So let's look at sugar and junk food taxes. And the question is it appropriate for state government to impose taxes in an effort to change personal behavior? For instance, it's estimated that roughly 20% of all Vermonters are obese, and sugar-sweetened foods are thought to be a major factor. Some lawmakers want to impose a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages to discourage the consumption of these products and to raise money for public health programs. Is this the right role of government, Marina Brown?
I don't believe so. Sugar tax hits lower-income people harder than it does people who can afford it. I think it's unfortunate to drink sweetened beverages, though I do it on a rare occasion. I think there's a better approach is education, and people consume sugar because it's a stimulant. They're stressed, and it's better to promote health through funding of recreation centers and biking paths and things like that, and trying to make people's lives better so they're not working 50, 60 hours a week just to survive. You drink soda to keep going when you are tired. You drink sweet stuff, and that's hitting poor people for that is not the way to do it.
Phil Scott, what do you think?
No, I think it's a terrible idea, and I don't believe we can implement such a thing. Where do you stop at that point? Do you stop? Do you move further? Do you tax Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Do you tax chips and so forth? A lot of it's the fat content and some of the ingredients in the products, not just the sugar, that creates obesity. But it brings up a good point. You know, we're looking at ways to fund our healthcare system, and I think we need to look more at prevention, because if you look yourself in the mirror, sometimes you can see the problem. It's us. You know, we're creating our own problems in terms of costs of healthcare, and we need to have more realization of that.
Is the philosophy behind a sugar-sweetened beverage tax really all that different than a tax on tobacco?
Probably not. But I just think, where do you can stop with the tobacco in terms of everything that's a cigarette you tax. But this is different. You have different levels of different types of food. Pasta is you gain a lot of weight eating pasta as well. So are you going to tax that? I mean, it's just, you can't stop there. Apple pie, you're going to tax that. Donuts, you know, we do tax donuts every now and then, but not a package of donuts, right? And our complicated tax system that we have right now, we need to simplify the tax system.
Dean Korn, what do you think?
Well, I think that Phil made the case for taxing sugar-sweetened drinks as opposed to this notion that where do you stop? Well, you stop in a reasonable place. I mean, we do tax tobacco because we want, firstly, in terms of tobacco, to get kids to stop smoking, and we know that that works, and it saves a lot of lives, and it helps with a lot of disease. Sweetened beverages make a lot of disease. They're not nutritious, and the thing we have to keep in mind is that we're constantly taxing good things. So if we're taxing things that drive up healthcare costs, that make people sick, those taxes can be used to offset the taxes that we have on things we want people to do. There are taxes on bicycle tires. You know, we have sales taxes on all sorts of things that would be better if we didn't have those taxes on, and those fall on low-income people.
Would you tax candy bars?
I'd be willing to listen to a hearing in the Senate and the House on that issue. As opposed to taxing other foods, I'd be willing to listen to taking taxes off of other items that people actually need. And the sales tax is a very regressive tax.
Let's look at income and economic disparity. And the question is, does state government have an obligation to narrow the wealth disparity among the citizens of Vermont? Now, this could be done by adopting a livable wage for all workers in the state and by imposing higher income taxes on wealthy people. Do you think both of these steps should be taken? Dean Korn?
Well, I think that it is a major concern for the state of Vermont, in addition to the entire nation. The increased wealth disparity that we have now has never been as great since the Great Depression. And that's where we're going to be headed if we have an unstable economy where regular working people have to work 2, 3, 4 jobs, and they still can't afford to buy the products that our producers are supposed to be making. So we're headed towards a very unstable economy, and it behooves the state to be involved in that question. Now, exactly how you do that in terms of taxes is a complicated issue, but moving towards a livable wage, you know, as a matter of law, we now calculate that every year in the state of Vermont, and we need to move towards that, and we've made some progress with the minimum wage, and we need to move it further. But there are other working conditions that we can improve also.
Phil Scott?
I think the growth of the economy is part of the answer. Creating more competition, creating a business climate that's more conducive to growth will actually help a lot of people out because there'll be more competition for employees and workers and so forth. We here in Vermont, we're an aging state. Our workforce is shrinking. We're seeing an exodus of many businesses. And I don't think we're doing enough to try and attract and keep businesses here in Vermont. And if we did that, I think that we would have more economic growth, prosperity, and opportunity for our youth.
Marina Brown,
with the minimum wage, raising it is essential. When workers don't have enough protections, when they don't have a union, the state can help protect by raising the minimum wage. It also has been proven to bring good workers to an area. If Vermont became a haven for highly skilled labor and we trained our people in high tech and machine making, people would come here because people were skilled. More unskilled labor is just going to lead to more poverty. Even if everybody has a Walmart job, it's not going to help everybody, even if that expands the economy.
You're listening to the Lieutenant Governor's Debate here on VPR. We're talking with the candidates about a range of issues, and the final topic in this round is energy, and we're going to go back to full one-minute answers and a follow-up question. Vermont has set a goal of getting 90% of its energy from renewable sources by 2050. That seems like a long way away when you think about it personally, but in terms of establishing energy sources and getting them up and running, 35 years is a very short time. Phil Scott, what's your vision of what that mix should look like? I'd like you to give me as detailed a description as possible. What's the role of solar? What's the role of wind? What is your calculation of our energy portfolio in 2050?
Well, I think we've seen some tremendous gains in solar over the last couple of decades. It's really become something that I think is going to be the future for some time to come. They're getting more and more. The panels are getting more efficient and producing more power. So I see solar as the biggest gain. I don't see that wind is going to grow all that much more here in the state of Vermont. I think that solar is the place to go. I do also think that some hydro, more hydro, is the answer. You know, when we look at our 90% goal, we could do that in a matter of a year, if we allowed the construction of the line going through Lake Champlain, that would bring about 800 megs of power through a 6-inch line. We could bring one of those in. That in itself, one line, would produce enough power, hydro renewable power, for the state to work.
In the last election cycle, you called for a moratorium on new wind projects in the state. Do you still think we should have a moratorium?
Well, it looks like we've had one. There hasn't been any new construction at this point in time. I'm still waiting for details on what if that is cost effective, whether it makes sense. I don't see that it's the future. It seems like older technology. The new technology is solar.
When you look at our portfolio, you mentioned a lot more solar development and hydro. Do you see hydro providing the baseline power, or do you think our solar systems will develop to the point where they can store more energy and that can be baseline power source?
Well, I mean, that's going to be the key for all of us in this world, is how do we store power? When we can break down and we can have the technology to actually store the power we produce, so that we can have on-demand type of an operation, that will be the key to our success. And then renewables will make so much more sense. It's all about storage, battery storage, and so forth. And we've made some tremendous gains there over the last decade as well. But we're going to have to make some major, major gains in order for that to happen. So, yes, I think hydro in the short run is the answer for baseload.
Dean Korn, what about you? What's your plan or your vision for Vermont's energy portfolio moving towards 90% renewables?
Well, first of all, I think we can not only meet 90% by 2050, I think we can get there sooner, and we need to. As our reaction to climate change, which is the way we're going to build jobs. We've already gotten a clean jobs industry report this summer that showed that we're up to 4.3% of the entire Vermont workforce is involved in clean energy, with a growth rate projected for next year of 12%, and there are very few industries that can match that. So that's incredibly important. The first source that hasn't even been mentioned yet is efficiency. By investing in efficiency, we're going to use a lot less power than we do now. We did that in Burlington when I was on the Burlington Electric Commission. We also invested in hydropower, which we just bought this spring, the voters approved, after we planned it in 1992. We also planned for the closure of Vermont Yankee and did that. And solar, wind, biomass, geothermal are also going to be important sources. There won't be a large expansion of hydro beyond what we have now. There'll be some repowering. The failure that the state did during the Douglas administration was to fail to buy the available power dams on the Deerfield River system.
How small scale do you see us going? Do you see solar on every roof? Do you see small scale energy being the future? Or are we going to have projects like Hydro-Québec that we're buying power from?
Oh, we're going to have a mixture. We're going to have you want to have wind and solar are complementary. Sometimes there's a lot of wind and there's no solar, and there's a lot of solar and no wind. So they actually work very, very well together, and you use the entire transmission system as your storage. We don't have cost-effective storage yet, but we will. We are able to have solar on various different scales from the roof. It's a little more expensive that way, but with new construction, it's terribly important. Also with new commercial and industrial construction and large residential construction, we definitely have tremendous capability with geothermal.
Marina Brown, what should Vermont's energy portfolio look like going forward? What are your specifics?
Wind, solar, hydro, and biomass. These are the elements. And as far as storage, we should be, instead of using money for wasteful things, perhaps start looking into superconducting magnet type storage or using fuel cells to store energy, which are people have looked at that for a long time. Efficiency, insulating people's houses, reducing our use of energy. We don't need an ever-expanding economy. What we need to do is spread the wealth so everyone is well-served and properly served in our economy. We don't need to have houses, huge houses that are kept at 80 degrees. We need to have modest, livable spaces.
Would you in some way mandate efficiency or create a way that people who were heating their houses to 80 degrees in the winter somehow paid more than their sort of standard share of the power?
Well, the state should be involved in helping people insulate their houses. I would not be opposed to people who don't have a great income actually getting their insulation for free. I mean, there's programs, and I'm for expanding those programs. Efficiency is really the way to go. I mean, I'd love to see houses with a 2 feet thick, 3 foot thick insulating walls.
Do you see a way to fund this moving forward that doesn't cost the state money as we transition power sources? I mean, right now, most of those renewable power sources cost more than the other power sources, like the energy that we've been getting from nuclear power. So how would you make that work financially?
Well, it would need to be paid for by taxes. But think of the cost if a nuclear power plant were to go bad. Think of the cost of coal power plants heating up the planet. It's the cost. It's not comparable. You know, Fukushima has destroyed most of a 30-kilometer area in Japan and contaminated much of the Pacific. Is that worth cheap power? I don't think so.
Well, coming up next, the candidates will directly question each other. And then later in the debate, we'll hear some questions that members of the public submitted on the issues of most importance to them. This is VPR. Welcome back to VPR's Lieutenant Governor's Debate. With us tonight, Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown, Republican Phil Scott, and Dean Corin, the progressive and Democratic candidate. I'm Bob Kinzel with Jane Lindholm.
In this round, the candidates ask each other questions one-on-one. Just a reminder, the questions shouldn't exceed 30 seconds. We're not looking for a speech from you. We're looking for a question for your opponent. Answers are a minute. Follow-up questions are encouraged, but they have to be on topic. All right.
Dean Corin, start us off. Who gets your first question?
I'll ask a question of Phil, going back to the property tax issue. Phil, you've been in the Senate and as lieutenant governor for 14 years. In terms of the property tax burden on working Vermont families, you voted for Act 68 during the last Republican administration, which has concentrated all increases on middle-income homeowners, so that now we have over 100 towns where residences pay a higher school tax rate than vacation houses. Do you regret that vote?
Well, again, I've been in politics now for 14 years, always served in the minority. It's been the Democrats that have been in charge. They set the agenda. I think that I wasn't alone in any of my votes. We had to have a majority in order to do that. I don't regret my votes on that, but I do feel that we need to focus on the spending side of the issue. There are many, many struggling Vermonters and putting all kinds of pressure on us as a society and our economy. And as far as second homeowners are concerned, I've got to say that I think we're pretty fortunate to have our second homeowners, so many that come to Vermont and decide to purchase homes here and actually participate in our economy and give us a lot of money. So I don't want to force them out. I think what we're doing is good.
And a follow-up is that so you want to have second homeowners not forced out, so it's okay for their rates to be lower compared to residential owners.
Yeah, I don't think we've done that, though. They're higher now.
We have 114 towns now where this never happened before Act 68, but where we now have residential homeowners paying considerably higher rates. In standard, it's 150% higher than a second homeowner.
Well, the second homeowners are paying a higher state rate than we are. We've raised it as a legislature a couple of times.
Marina Brown, who gets your first question?
That'll have to be Dean. Dean, the Progressive Party feels that that war is kind of a waste of money and that we should redirect our military spending elsewhere. What's your answer to the U.S. being involved in war everywhere? What do you think can be done to rein this back?
Well, in recent history, the best thing that could have been done is not to elect George Bush, who would get us involved in Iran, really ruin any opportunity to make progress in Afghanistan and end up with a Middle East that is thoroughly destabilized and shows very little promise of any kind of peace anywhere in the near future. And even now, it is very, very difficult to tell. If you listen to Peter Galbraith, who's an expert on the Middle East, who is just leaving our Vermont Senate now, you can see how very difficult it is to even know which side to be on and which supporting which side will result in the least bloodshed in the long term, not to mention involvement of Americans and our money, and it's where our giant deficits come from, trillion-dollar deficits.
Can I redirect to Phil?
No, you can have a follow-up. You'll have another chance.
Okay. I've got no more to say on that.
All right. Phil Scott, who gets your first question?
Well, I'm going to give one to Marina, a very softball type of question. But we've been fairly well-known. Dean served in the legislature previously. I've been in the legislature as well. We don't know much about you. You live up in the Northeast Kingdom. Curious about your background. What brought you to Vermont?
Well, I'm not that important. What I am is a computer programmer that lives in a tiny house that's attached to a trailer in the Northeast Kingdom. I drew the short straw. That's why I'm here as a candidate. I'm a longtime Liberty Union Party supporter, and I was asked to run because they needed a candidate.
So the goal for you to run is to hopefully get enough of a percentage so you continue to become a party affiliate?
Well, we would like to have major party status for the upcoming 2016 elections, and we want to draw the debate in Vermont to the left.
Again, you're listening tonight to VPR's debate with three candidates for lieutenant governor, and in this segment, the candidates get to question each other directly on key issues in this race and what's most important to them. Marina Brown, what's your next question, and who's it for?
Well, it's for Phil. I asked Dean about the United States involvement all over the planet. Looking at it from putting on a conservative hat, I would say that this was fiscally irresponsible to be involved in wars all over the world and having our military involved in country after country after country. Would you change that, and how would you?
Well, obviously, some of the wars we've been involved in have been to help out the citizens when there's atrocities going on in different countries, and I think we have to respond. We're the real world leader, and we should act appropriately to help those folks out that can't help themselves. I am concerned about some of the wars, which I feel have been about oil, to tell you the truth. And I think that we as a society, we as Americans, we should be able to become more self-sufficient. We should become more independent. I think we can all agree, no matter what party we're a member of, that we as a group, as the United States, should be able to take care of ourselves without having to rely on other foreign investments and foreign oil, to tell you the truth.
As far as ISIS is involved, the U.S. is supposedly going after ISIS in Iraq and Syria because they're attacking the Kurds. We also, at the same time, helped Turkey attack the PKK, which is the main Kurdish Communist Party, which is the main Kurdish rebel group in fighting for a Kurdish homeland. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think we underestimated ISIS, and we did so from the beginning. And maybe if we had better intelligence and were able to squelch some of their activity and at least monitor it better, we wouldn't be in the position we are today.
Phil Scott, you have a question next.
Sure. This is a question for Dean. As you know, the governor travels quite a bit. He's been away for 145 days over the last 2 years. So you never know what's going to come up during those times. And I've had to take some responsibility for some things during those times. Ebola is an issue that's facing us. It's very topical today. And I guess my question is fairly simple. When somebody comes to Vermont that has traveled abroad in some of those countries, should we have voluntary or involuntary quarantine?
That's a good question. It's a very evolving question. I'm not sure what the governor travel part has to do with the Ebola question, but
because you would be in charge at that point, you might have to make that decision.
Well, I'm willing to be in charge at any point, but
you got your chance right now.
I can tell you that if I can get through today's schedule, I could handle any schedule the governor throws at me, and any issues that come my way. The Ebola situation right now is one for folks in Vermont to be very calm about. Listen to what the CDC has to say about it. If we have a situation where someone is coming from abroad in an area where they have potentially been exposed to Ebola, the kind of process that went on today in Vermont where someone is voluntarily quarantining themselves, they have no symptoms yet. We now know from the CDC that not only do you need to have symptoms, but you need to have serious symptoms before you're actually contagious to other people. So we simply need to be calm about it and listen to the CDC and lay out those protocols.
This person can leave at any time, voluntary or involuntary. Let's say he walks away. Are you going to have them confined?
I think that would depend on recommendations from the health department and the CDC.
Your decision today, though.
Well,
you got to make
the
decision.
If it was my decision today, I would call the CDC and I would call the health commissioner.
Dean Corin, your turn.
Okay. Another one for Phil. Phil, this summer I held a press conference on the high gasoline prices in northwest Vermont, often a 30-cent difference between Rutland and St. Albans. I was joined by Attorney General Bill Sorrell in calling for passing a bill that would require fuel wholesalers in Vermont to provide data so the AG could determine whether there were any uncompetitive practices that could be costing Vermonters over $20 million per year. You talk about affordability, but why didn't you do anything to help move the bill forward in the Senate? And don't Vermonters have the right to wonder whether it has anything to do with your large fuel industry contributions, including a $4,000 contribution from fuel dealer Skip Valley?
Well, as I recall, there was a bill in the House, and they didn't take it up.
Actually, they did.
So it came to the Senate?
Hearings in the House. There was also a bill in the Senate.
I don't remember a bill coming over from the House in the Senate.
It didn't come over from the House, but they could have simultaneously gotten a hearing in the Senate. Did you do anything to promote it?
I wasn't even aware of it.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Thank you.
Interesting in what way? That I don't know.
Well,
the 1,211 bills that came across in the legislature this year that I didn't know that there was one.
$20 million of affordability for working Vermonters paying extra gasoline prices. That's just going into profits. It's not helping do anything in Vermont. And it's interesting that you weren't aware of that bill, which Bernie Sanders had held many press conferences on, had a federal investigation that led to the state bill, and the Attorney General was calling for the bill.
Then it's a Democratic, last I checked, it's a democratically controlled House, democratically controlled Senate. And if the Attorney General Sorrell, who's a Democrat, wanted a bill to move forward, why didn't he speak to Shap Smith, John Campbell, and the governor, and say, "We want this. I need this bill." Why wouldn't he do that?
Well, I believe he did do that.
Well, then why didn't they act? I mean, I'm in the minority. I'm just the lieutenant governor.
All right. Well, you're responsible for your own actions, though.
Well, they're the ones. They're the ones leading the Senate and the House and the administration, last I checked.
Okay.
You are listening to VPR's debate for Lieutenant Governor, and as you can tell, the three candidates are questioning each other. We're in our third round now. Phil Scott, you get the next question. Who's it for?
Dean Corin. As we've known in many of these debates, I've been very clear about my position on a woman's right to choose. I'm pro-choice. You've known my position. We've talked about it. And yet, in the last week, you came out with an ad that you developed created an ad that wasn't factual, it was disingenuous and misleading. Why would you do that?
Well, thanks, Phil. I didn't do that. I put out an ad that said you were endorsed by the Vermont Right to Life Committee.
Which was not factual.
And the Vermont Right to Life Committee, if you look on their website, says that they recommended you. If you look in the thesaurus, you will see that recommended and supported and endorsed are all synonyms. Vermont Digger reported that as an endorsement also, and that is in fact what it is. And they endorsed you because you say you're pro-choice, but you also support some limitations on choice that makes the Vermont Right to Life Committee very happy and caused Planned Parenthood to instead endorse me very strongly.
Well, again, the Vermont Right to Life Committee said to you that we did not endorse Phil Scott.
Well, they said they recommended you. And if you look on their website, they clearly recommend
They did not endorse me.
And recommend and endorse mean the same thing.
Dean Corin, who gets your last question?
Got to give you another one, Phil. During this campaign, I've argued that in a number of ways you seem to be out of sync with Vermonters' values and priorities, including health care reform, reproductive choice, and addressing climate change. Then, a couple of weeks ago on VPR, you confirmed that climate change, quote, isn't your priority. Is that why you supported the appointment of a climate change denier and someone who also wanted to get rid of Vermont's bottle bill to the key position of chairing the Senate Natural Resources Committee?
Well, again, I don't make those decisions on my own. It's the Committee on Committees, the present pro tem, a Democrat, Senator Mazza, a Democrat, and myself are the three that make the decisions on the committee assignments. And so, accusing me of determining what who gets the chairs, I think, is a bit disingenuous and misleading as well. I think Bob Hartwell is a great leader in terms of his committee. He chaired the Institutions Committee before the Natural Resources Committee and did a terrific job, brought the committee consensus together, worked that we had all his committee members had thought he did a great job in how he ran the committee. And so I would argue that he did a wonderful job in the structure of the committee. And the question about the litmus test that you referred to never came up.
So on a committee of committees of three people, of which you were one, you never sought to know the views of someone you were appointing to chair Natural Resources? And can you be clear on that question and also whether you supported it or opposed that appointment?
Well, again, I supported Bob Hartwell while being chair of Natural Resources, to be clear. The question never came up. I knew the view of, let's say, Senator Claire Eyre in her view of single payer and so forth, and her view on physician-assisted suicide. But I still voted in favor of her becoming a chair because I think she does a great job running a committee. So it had nothing to do with my personal views or what their personal views are. It's more about the chemistry of the committee and the structure of the Senate. As you preside, you need to take leadership and make sure you put people in appropriate places so that we can move Senate legislation along.
Marina Brown, who gets your last question?
That would have to be Dean. Drug company, there's a number of drugs called branded generics, like tetracycline, Hyclate. It used to be like $20 to $50 for a bottle of a pharmacy bottle. Now it's over $1,800 for a bottle of that because one drug company has monopolized the production of this drug. Dean, would you support very strong sanctions against pharmaceutical companies that are clearly engaging in gouging?
Well, certainly. If there's price gouging and anti-competitive practices, then the state attorney general should step in. But even beyond that, once we do healthcare reform, we'll be able to negotiate for drug prices for 626,000 Vermonters at a go and get the kind of price reductions that Vermonters are entitled to, which our federal government not only failed to do, but basically prohibited the kind of negotiation we need to do. When I worked for Bernie Sanders, we arranged buses for seniors to go to Canada to get their drugs at one-tenth the price as here in the U.S. Top quality Canadian American drugs just over the border. And that's the kind of action that put a lot of pressure on the federal government, but not enough. But that's the kind of thing we can do for Vermont ourselves.
Would you support very stiff sanctions, such as seizing drug companies' assets that engage in these monopolistic behaviors?
The kind of thing you're talking about, seizing things, would be more of a federal, nuclear option, so to speak. But what the state of Vermont could do in those kinds of abuses is typically join with other states and bring lawsuits that could end up with rewards that the state of Vermont could share in, just like it did with the tobacco settlement awards, that could actually subsidize our healthcare system.
That concludes this round of the Lieutenant Governor's debate here on VPR. The candidates we're hearing from tonight are Republican Phil Scott, Dean Corin, who's the Progressive and Democratic nominee, and Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown. Coming up next, they'll answer questions posed by the public. This is VPR. Welcome back to VPR's Lieutenant Governor's debate with Progressive Democrat Dean Corin, Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown, and Republican Phil Scott. I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm here with Bob Kinzel.
And we've been encouraging our listeners to write and record questions for the candidates, and we turn this round of questioning over to you. So let's hear our first question.
This is Dave Ransom in Waterville. Since 1995, the Department of Defense has been militarizing police departments through the willingness of the states and local communities. What will you do about reversing this trend?
Dean Korn?
That's a great question, and I know there are there's a lot of folks throughout Vermont who are concerned about this. The DOD making military equipment available to police forces on every level in Vermont. And I think that this is the kind of thing that Vermont could take control of itself in a very reasonable and thoughtful way. There is equipment that, if it's at lower cost because the military is getting rid of it, that can help our police forces, that's great. But if it's equipment that engenders a real militarization, and I'm not talking about defensive equipment for police officers, but very offensive equipment, very high caliber weapons, and really military style operation weapons that encourage that kind of operation. That's something that the state of Vermont could definitely put a limitation on.
Is that happening now?
Is the transfer of equipment happening now? Absolutely.
Are your concerns going on right now, I guess is my question.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I reflect the concerns that I hear from Vermonters around the state that there are concerns about this kind of thing. And they should definitely bring it to their legislators, and the legislature could definitely act on this. There's some equipment that would be totally appropriate and others that I think most Vermonters would consider inappropriate. The fact of the matter is, if you have a hammer, problems tend to look like nails. And if you have equipment that engenders a certain kind of operation, it can be a problem for the state of Vermont.
Marina Brown, what do you think?
I'm totally opposed to the militarization of police. I think we need to look at the model of police departments around the world that are not killing people every day. It's a tragedy that that many minority people look at the police as an enemy. I mean, I've had seen police break a friend's back in front of my face. I don't want to see police with military weapons. I don't want them to have tanks. I'd like them to back out of the position where everyone is the enemy. If, as Dean said, all you got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And police are afraid, they're defensive. They need to get in a position like some of the European countries where in Germany, they fired like 86 bullets 2 years ago. Total, the whole year, and they shot one person. Most of those were warning shots. In the United States, over 400 people are shot every year by police, and that's not even a complete total. And that doesn't count the amount of people that are injured and brutalized. We need to back away from this position. This is a byproduct of the war on terror and the United States being at war with East Asia and West Asia for 13, 14 years. War does not breed a peaceful society at home, and we need to get out of wars abroad, and the government needs to stop waging war on minority communities at home.
Phil Scott.
Well, I think some of the equipment is over the top, but I think that we could handle that on the local level in terms of local police forces and so forth. We have select boards and we have city councils, and they can make determinations themselves on what they spend money or what they want for equipment. If it's for the state police, we can do that through the appropriations bill as well. If we see an issue when we're debating that the equipment needed, then I think that's how to handle it. But a top-down approach at this point, I don't see that it's necessary.
Our next question comes from Dan, who posted this on Facebook. While we have the highest taxes, we have the worst roads and bridges in New England. What do you propose to do about it? Marina Brown?
Well, I don't think we should have to drive everywhere. I hate driving. I think there should be public transit pretty much going leaving for everywhere every 15 minutes. And if I would guess a lot of Vermonters, if we had really good public transit that was free or very cheap, they wouldn't be driving and the roads would be better. We can't outlaw the bad winters of Vermont, though. That's part of the problems in the state.
How would you pay for that public transit system?
Well, that's another thing that should be paid for by a progressive income tax, and everyone benefits from that.
Not a gas tax.
not a gas tax. I mean, that hits people who have to drive. I guess if we had public transit everywhere, it might be less unfair to have a gas tax.
Phil Scott, your thoughts.
Well, we're in a position at this point because of actions we took probably 20 or 25 years ago. We were transferring $50 to $60 million a year out of the transportation fund for other purposes. And we did that over quite a period of time, over a couple of decades. So having said that, that $500 million probably could have gone to good use for our infrastructure at that point in time. But it's left us in a condition that is tough to get out of, literally trying to dig our way out. And we've had some gains. I think that it's not going to happen overnight, but I think our bridges have improved. We took some action over the last 5 or 6 years, stopped the transfer of money out of the transportation fund, or at least lowered it to a reasonable number. And I think that is having an effect. And the future, though, is how do we raise revenue in order to do it? Because the per gallon tax is something that, with our fuel efficiency standards, which are getting better, the cars are getting better mileage, we're having less revenue to work with. So it's an issue that we have to deal with.
And Dean Corin.
I think we clearly need more investment in our infrastructure, in not only the roads, but the bridges that we have that are substandard. And there has been disinvestment, but primarily at the federal level in those areas. And I'm glad that we have a federal delegation that's working hard to redress that, both in terms of the infrastructure improvements we need and in terms of the jobs that it would create. One thing, we have gone down some wrong paths, I believe, in terms of building some new roads that we didn't actually need, like the Circ Highway. And fortunately, that was stopped where it is now. And also, if you go down to downtown Bennington and ask the storekeepers what they think of the Bennington bypass, you'll see a lot of harm that's been done by that investment. Sure, most of it was federal money, but the state had to put money in too, and that took people and engineers off of bridges and other roads that we have that we could be repairing.
So here's a question from Bob in Charlotte. Our state waters are in bad shape. Given Vermont's sparse population density, it's downright embarrassing. State government has been nibbling around the edges of this issue at best. What will it take for our government agencies and legislature to develop and execute a real plan to clean up our water? Phil Scott?
Well, I think money would be the first solution there. And then the question is, how do we raise that revenue? I'm encouraged. We did receive a grant, a federal grant. I'm not sure of the details of that grant. I was in the St. Albans area probably a month ago and met with some leaders from that area. And they're upset. They want the bay cleaned up. They want Lake Carmi cleaned up. They'd like to see the $45 million put to actual cleanup costs rather than more studies. And so I think that's first and foremost. If we can utilize that money and do some actual cleanup and use some new technology in doing it, I think it's doable. Lake Champlain is a precious resource, and as the caller or the writer had said, it's something that we all have to pay attention to because of tourism and our just quality of life.
Some people blame dairy farms for this problem. Is that fair?
I think it's fair to assume that there is some discharge from dairy farms. I think that when we had put that was one of my arguments, not that we should do something there, but the point pollution in terms of some of our public sewer plants. We tried to reduce the amount of phosphorus going through there, and we spent millions, tens of millions of dollars to decrease that by a couple of percentage when we probably should have been looking to help on the non-point sources, some of the fields and discharges there. And I think we would have made more significant gains by doing so.
Dean Corin.
Well, this is clearly a priority for many Vermonters, and it's an environmental issue, it's a tourism issue, it's a healthy drinking water issue. and just the ability to use the lake. We have not had, over the last several years, an effect on it that counteracted, that was more significant than the effect of climate change warming the waters and resulting in blue-green algae blooms. So we've actually fallen behind, even with the Clean and Clear initiative of the Douglas administration. We barely tread water, so to speak. And what we're finding out now is that a lot of the phosphorus that's leaching into the lake is historical and is in the fields that was put in years ago. And with the increased rain that we're having now, we're actually seeing that go into the lake more. So we definitely need some new approaches. That $45 million grant from the federal government will help with planning and moving to some new approaches. But this is a huge problem, and it is absolutely not sorted out yet as to how we're going to move forward.
It could take hundreds of millions of dollars to solve this problem. Where is that money going to come from?
That's a really good question. And there are, obviously, we've just mentioned three issues where throwing money at the problem would actually be a pretty good idea. But in this case, one of the areas that could be the result of proceeds from a carbon tax or something like that, that helps us move towards more efficiency and helps us move in that direction, would potentially be available for some of these offsets.
Marina Brown?
Well, I'd like to see a committee of farmers, scientists, and local people attack the problem. Farmers know about the land perhaps better than anyone else, even, and they can show stuff to scientists about runoff if they know they're not going to be penalized for that. I think starting a committee of that with buy-in from all the affected groups, with the best, best farmers and the best scientists, would be a good way to use some of that money to clean up the lakes or start cleaning up the lakes.
And what if more money is needed?
Well, as usual, I advocate steep progressive income tax. I don't want to hit poor the skilled workers that call themselves middle class. I don't want to hit them hard. So I want to hit the higher end for their share of that.
You're listening to VPR's Lieutenant Governor Debate. We're hearing questions now posed to the candidates from our listeners. Sarah posted this question to Facebook. Will you be pursuing GMO labeling and fighting back against big corporations that try to challenge the people of Vermont? Marina Brown.
Well, I advocate more than GMO labeling. I don't think most Vermonters really want GMOs in their food. If that is indeed the will of the people in Vermont, GMOs should be banned. And if the pollen comes over Lake Champlain from New York, the Monsanto or whoever created this GMO pollen could be sued for having a defective product that goes into other people's land. Right now, Monsanto will sue farmers whose corn is pollinated by their pollen. I'm for turning that around. And if their pollen contaminates someone's organic or traditional grain, they should be treated as trespassers and pay for the crop for contaminating it.
So you'd like to see the state go farther than just requiring a label on food that's produced with genetic engineering. You'd like them to take more steps towards actual seeds that are genetically engineered.
Yes. Countries like Hungary have banned GMOs altogether. I think there is a place for modified foods. But if the people don't want them, they should not be here. That's what democracy is for. It shouldn't be Monsanto sues Vermont in court, as they're planning to. If the federal courts held against Vermont in favor of Monsanto, I think that would be good reason for Vermont to think about going on its own.
Phil Scott, your thoughts on the GMO labeling law and fighting back against big corporations that try to challenge the people of Vermont?
I wasn't in favor of the approach that we took in terms of GMO labeling and going it alone approach. I believe that we deserve to know what's in our food. I think we should label. But we had an option. We could have waited and gone with other states that have considered the same language and have a trigger so that we could go in with them, so we wouldn't be the one fighting this fight all alone with our limited resources. The money that we're spending, we'll spend millions of dollars on this alone. And I would rather put that money towards helping the Department of Children and Families. We've just identified that we have a shortage of caseworkers there. I'd rather use the money for that than to fight this challenge. I was part of the Natural Resources Committee in my first couple of years in the Senate, and we worked with the mercury legislation in the same way, but we put a trigger in. Where when other states came aboard, that we would be able to utilize that trigger in order to fight the fight from a fiscal standpoint.
Dean Corn?
When I was in the House, I put in a toxics bill, and I was told that this is great for economic development for Montpelier because it means that all these lobbyists will come in from out of state and spend money in hotel rooms and restaurants. But, of course, the bill never would have a chance to pass, and that was a bill that dealt with Monsanto, as a matter of fact. But I think most Vermonters are incredibly proud of what the state has done as far as GMO labeling. So Vermonters have a right to know what's in their food. And I think they're especially proud that Vermont has evidenced this can-do attitude in moving forward and fighting it, and not only using our own money, but raising outside money to do that too. And I think that's a brilliant approach. And I think we're going to ultimately prevail. And In not every case do we need to be first, but in some cases we do, and this was a good case that I think all Vermonters can be proud of.
We got this email from Mike in St. Albans. Mike writes, there's little evidence that tax cuts actually create economic growth anywhere in the nation. Do any of the candidates still believe that cutting taxes here in Vermont will be beneficial for Vermont's economy or the average Vermonter in light of these experiments in other states? Phil Scott?
I think there are some tax incentives that that help lure companies into to the state. I think we've seen that. I've worked with trying to attract businesses from other areas alongside the governor. We've tried to bring them in, but we simply have had trouble competing with North Carolina and other states, even New York, in terms of what they're doing right now. When you look at some of their campaign, Governor Cuomo has done a great marketing job in promising no taxes for 10 years, let's say. And while we can't go head-to-head with New York, we still have to compete in some way. So I would say having a few tools in the toolbox is helpful for those of us that have to go out and try and attract new business to Vermont.
Dean Corn, what do you think about tax credits from the state to lure businesses here?
I think they're generally a bad idea. I think Phil made the case. They don't actually work. We cannot compete with wealthier states in the race to the bottom to lower our standards. And those jobs, if they do come in from those out-of-state companies, are insecure and are just as readily lured away by another state somewhere else. I think the key to economic development, especially now in this technological age, is the small innovative companies that are growing in Vermont. Some are in computers, some are in programming, some are in foods. We're going to have the Ben and Jerry's of peanut butter in Vermont. Vermont peanut butter is going to take over that market. It's creating a whole market of high-quality peanut butter. There are things going on in Vermont that are so exciting that I've been touring around the state going to small businesses. These are businesses with 2 to 5 people now, and a year from now they're going to have 10 or 15 people, and that's where the job growth potential is, and that's where the jobs for most jobs, of course, in Vermont are from small businesses, and that's where the businesses are that are going to stay here in Vermont. Ello was recently got a lot of attention internationally because of the software they've developed, and they made it very clear their goal is to stay right here in Vermont where they began, and for people who love Vermont, this is where we want to encourage them, and low tax rates do not help small starting businesses. What they need is capital availability, and what they need is trained employees.
Marina Brown, what do you think about this idea of the state offering tax credits to businesses?
I don't agree with it. And Phil mentioned the state of North Carolina. We don't want to turn Vermont into a right-to-work state. North Carolina is a right-to-work state. We don't want to make people as miserable as possible so that jobs come here. We want to train our workers so they know how to do high-tech jobs. We want to lift people up as much as possible. And rather than making longer and longer work week, perhaps shortening the work week so more people can work. We don't need to have long work weeks. Why not share the wealth a little bit more evenly?
We got this from Al in Enosburg. As Lieutenant Governor, do you promise to support the implementation of legislation like healthcare reform or anything else, even if you don't agree with it? Dean Korn?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. In a way, it's something like healthcare reform is so complex, has so many moving parts, that it's impossible to agree with everything. However, there are some basic fundamental principles of equity and fairness and universality, and the people of Vermont really making the healthcare decisions ourselves, and good coverage. There is no reason to have a plan that has poor coverage that puts copays and deductibles onto Vermonters, because in the end, it's Vermonters who are paying those bills. And we are big enough with 600,000 people to know what and to budget for most health care occurrences, and that's what we should do.
I don't think that's the question. The question is, as Lieutenant Governor, are you going to have a problem helping to implement legislation that you don't support?
Well, first of all, the lieutenant governor doesn't implement legislation. The lieutenant governor has the duties that are assigned by the Constitution, plus the lieutenant governor is free to promote policies that the people of Vermont are asking for and to help craft them in legislation and to work within the administration to make those policies come out in a reasonable way. So it's not a matter of executing the policies as it is creating the policies. And as I say, something like health care reform is going to have a lot of pieces. I guarantee any plan that comes out is going to have a lot of pieces I don't like. But if on balance it meets the fundamental principles, I will support it and make sure that the state does everything in its implementation to carry it out.
Marina Brown?
Well, as a socialist, I understand that in a capitalist system, I'm not going to get what I want. So if I were elected, I would be traveling around promoting policies that help the poorest in Vermont. I would be listening a lot. And where things would help people, yes, I'd work, but I would be fighting very hard against anything that would stab the poor people.
Phil Scott?
Well, I wouldn't blindly support anything that I didn't understand or didn't agree with. Having said that, every single day in the legislature, you're watching bills that you might not support or you may support that you don't have a voice in. You don't get a vote when they're passed by the Senate. You sign them and they get sent to the House. So if that's the question, I do my constitutional duty and sign those bills because that's democracy.
We have just enough time now for a lightning round, and candidates, we'd love to get your positions on the record with short responses, about 30 seconds, to a number of questions. And we're going to start with an issue of climate change. You've all said that climate change is real, so what can the lieutenant governor do to make a difference in climate change? Dean Korn?
This gets very exciting because climate change is happening, and it's going to happen even if we try to ignore it. But Vermont's not ignoring it. Vermont developed and is updating its climate assessment for the state of Vermont that is subsidiary to the National Climate Assessment, which was just updated in May. And we have laid out a response to climate change in terms of emergency issues and so forth that is excellent. What we haven't yet done and what I will do as lieutenant governor, is to move that forward to a job creation program.
Marina Brown.
Well, I would travel around the state and I would promote policies that would help retard climate change, solar, and help people get the help they need for insulation and and solar cells and wind. And I'd have to be there when climate change causes horrendous disasters. I mean, it's a number of years ago, I ran the Vermont 100, and I was very proud that the race director was on the scene helping people where no one else could get to them, using her skills as logistics to serve people who are cut off because of the hurricane.
And Phil Scott.
I would do what I've been doing for the last 4 years in bringing people together, bringing all factions together, trying to find a goal that they all can agree to. Whatever the issue is with climate change, I think whether you're conservative and you want to just save money, whether you want to reduce carbon emissions, we should be able to accomplish that. The same goal in mind, spend less time arguing about why and focus on the problem itself.
Let's move on to vaccines, a contentious topic for many Vermont parents. Should Vermont require all children to be fully immunized before going to school? In other words, no more philosophical exemptions. Marina Brown?
I'm for vaccinations. It's a risk to have people not vaccinated. That being said, there are a number of vaccines that you could safely forego. Let's say chickenpox. I got the actual disease, but it's best to have people vaccinated.
Would you eliminate the philosophical exemption?
Yes.
Phil Scott?
Yes, I'm in favor of vaccination, and I would eliminate that exemption.
And Dean Corn?
I agree. The word philosophical exemption does harm to the word philosophy.
All right, we'll move on to another topic. Guns, Vermont's gun laws. Are they too strict, not strict enough, or just right? Dean Corn?
I think that in the near future, the only change that we need to make in Vermont that I think most Vermonters support is background checks.
Marina Brown.
I'm not for changes on gun laws. However, if someone's proven to be violent, they shouldn't be having weapons. And I include that as if a police officer has shot somebody, they shouldn't be carrying a gun until it's absolutely proven that it was self-defense and was unavoidable.
Phil Scott.
We should enforce the laws that we have right now.
All right. So this is a sort of to get at your sense of being and your stubbornness, to have lack of a better word for it. What's an issue that you have had a very firm position on, and then as you learned more about the issue, you changed your mind? Marina Brown?
Well, I'd have to think about that. I came in supporting the beverage tax on the sweetened beverage, and I tended to support the carbon tax. But when I talked to people who were poor, they kind of hammered me about that. And you say, "I don't have any money. That would hurt me." And I thought of other ways of dealing with it.
Phil Scott.
The Greenmount Care Board being one, the formation of such, I wasn't in favor of that. I thought it was just a waste of $1.5 million a year to try and come up with a plan for single payer, when I thought that was the job of the administration. And I've been pleasantly surprised going to some of the public hearings, seeing what they are doing, working alongside the providers and hospitals. They are making a difference, and they are cutting the costs of the rise in healthcare costs.
Dean Corn.
Well, one is the gas tax. Initially, the notion is that the gas tax will fall very unfairly on lower-income people, especially those who have to commute long distances in rural Vermont. But it turns out that we can couple that with a registration change so that we have value-based registration of cars, and we can actually save low-income people more than it would cost in the gas tax. The gas tax, a third of it's paid by out-of-staters, which is very handy for Vermont.
So that's a change in position.
That's
for you?
A change that would allow us to do that. Yeah.
You are listening to VPR's Lieutenant Governor's Debate. We have time for one last closing question. The Lieutenant Governor can often make the job what he or she wants it to be. If elected, what would be your very top priority? Marina Brown?
Advocating for working and poor people in oppressed communities. That's why I'm running. I'm here to advocate for people who don't necessarily have the best voice advocating for them. And I would be listening for problems. I'd be going around the state looking for problems that need solutions. I'm basically an engineer by trade, and maybe that means I don't listen as well as I should. People do tell me that, but I look for solutions, and that would be what I would be doing.
Phil Scott?
It would be easing the crisis of affordability that I think we're facing in this state. Where by doing so, we'd have to address the property tax issue. I think we need to be a better partner with businesses that are existing here in the state and try and adopt some policies to help grow the economy and raise revenue so that we can do a better job. And demographics makes an incredible difference. So we're losing our youth here, and our society's growing older, but we're losing that category of between 25 and 45.
Dean Korn?
Well, everyone's going to be working on property tax reform and also health care reform. And my personal top priority comes from my background, which is in energy, renewable energy and energy science. And I see us as having tremendous potential for job growth. When I was in the House, I stopped utility deregulation that would have taken the power away from Vermont and also cost us hundreds of millions of dollars. And even its proponents now are very grateful that we didn't do that. So we do have the tools to move forward with saving ourselves very significant money and improving our environmental performance.
Well, that concludes tonight's debate. I'd like to thank the candidates for participating, Republican Phil Scott, Dean Korn, who is the Progressive and Democratic nominee, and also Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown. Thanks very much for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
The election is 1 week away, and VPR will be providing live coverage all evening on Tuesday, November 4th.
VPR's election debates are produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. Our director is Peter Biello. The executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was written and performed by Eric Uwazen and the New Trombone Collective. For Bob Kinzel, I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening, and good night.